Okay, thanks for the introduction. The statement that I told you everything you know about gamma ray bursts is probably characteristically modest. These surpassed me years ago already, I think I can pretty much say. My name is Henrik van Eertuin from the University of Bath in the United Kingdom. For those of you who don't know where that actually is, here, London there, Bath there. Bath is a very well-known, I'm not going to give a whole talk about Bath, don't worry. But Bath is actually a well-known place, at least in the UK, for being quite old and having, of course, Roman influences. Bath literally is about Roman baths that are there. The students have their graduation ceremonies here in the Abbey, but if they're not doing the these ceremonies, they're here where you can see it's sort of sloping already. We're on the hill, so we're not in the center of town. Bath is on a hilly campus. It's also a city well-known for example, the connection to Jane Austen. It was a quote from Jane Austen. I have some more timely quotes about actually getting into Bath nowadays, for example, when they close a crucial bridge. But I'll keep those offline. What I want to talk about, though, again, is not just Bath, but gamma ray bursts. Now, this is a movie that is shown in many, many talks on this particular subject. So some of you may have already seen it, so I already apologize if this is too familiar. But Jeff actually confirmed that this might be useful to keep for those of you who haven't seen this before. It's just to set the stage, right? What is a gamma ray burst? A gamma ray burst is... are there people now online who will not see this?
They are seeing this.
They're seeing.
Yeah.
Oh, if I do this, they will see this?
Yeah.
No. Then I do something else. I have an... But this, everybody will see, of course. Yeah. A hockey stick. Yeah. No, I've got this. Anyway, so what happens is that some cataclysmic event will trigger the formation of a black hole. Presumably, there may be a neutral star formed for a while or indefinitely, but the common scenario is the birth of a black hole, producing, among other things, a fast-moving relativistic outflow that will give rise to the gamma ray burst and some sort of long-lasting aftermath. And that's what the animation is showing. So there's a black hole engine. This animation assumes it's a black hole. A prompt emission lasting seconds of gamma rays may be produced by this internal collision of the outflow. And then eventually, as it must do, this relativistic flow of gamma 100s or so, it has to be very high. We know that because it has to outpace pair production opacity issues. So it has to really be fast if you are to see this in gamma rays. And eventually it will just deposit energy out there, which will interact with the environment and then trigger a decelerating blast wave that will be seen in different frequencies. So to schematically depict that here. Again, there's an accretion disk. You launch your jet via something happening in the accretion disk, not my expertise per se. I simulate stuff further out, mostly. And there are all sorts of facets to this outflow that are more or less important to different parts of the afterglow that you eventually see from this blast wave. So here I depict a few, not all of these are going to feature prominently in the talk though. But what you get is you drop some energy out there. And when I give a presentation and use the word jet, and there are AGN people in the audience, they sometimes tend to think this is an ongoing process, but it's not, right? You're popping a cork, you're blowing a lid off, effectively. So the jet is a jetted outflow here while the engine is active, but the scales are vastly different here. We are going to 10 to the 13 centimeters, 15, and so forth, whereas only here we're at 10 to the 10-ish or so. So the jet thing means really some sort of blast wave, effectively. There's still material ejected, so there will be some sort of shock crossing back and forth, even after those internal collisions that may cause the prompt emission, and they will affect the dynamics. But eventually there will be some sort of self-similar solution applicable to relativistic outflows, if you assume radial flow. That is a not unreasonable assumption in the beginning. And in an ultra-relativistic limit, you get a self-similar solution, which you may or may not have encountered. More people may be familiar with something called the set of Taylor blast wave solution, a well-known textbook problem where you just deposit energy, whether you model a nuclear bomb or a gamma ray burst, afterglow is then immaterial. You just have a lot of energy and you get a self-similar outflow profile. In between, though, is where sort of the simulators come in, because here you have 2D features, or 3D really, of course, but at minimum 2D features that come with spreading of this outflow that you can't automatically just capture with a simplified model, because they're quite sensitive to the simplifications that these models use. On the right-hand side, just to not skip parts on the slides, is of course a bit of a schematic picture of what happens. Neutron stars merge in one channel to form these bursts, the neutron star merger channel, as opposed to the massive star collapsing channel. I'll get to that distinction. I'll get back to that later on. And again, you launch this kind of jet. This cocoon would be whatever is being happening in the interaction between this jet as this being launched, propagating through a stellar envelope, say, for again a massive star collapsing, or trying to make its way out of kilonova, ejecta, dense neutrino-driven winds, or whatever happens around these neutron star mergers. Now, I am aware that I'm, of course, at a particular location giving this talk. So I thought I'd just put some bullet points here. So why could people here potentially care, even if not working gamma ray bursts? The top bullet point, again, is outside of my expertise. But it's, of course, an important thing to mention. And people here are working on this, right? I spoke with Luciano Combi, who I think is doing these kind of simulations. And Jeff sort of gets there a little bit with his work. But even so, if you wait long enough, you don't need to worry about general relativity. You're too far out, so it doesn't matter. But you still have a relativistic flow problem to solve. This, of course, is a big deal for the perspective from the perspective of gravity-interested academics. We indeed do now have a solid confirmation of a gamma ray burst as being tied to a source of gravitational waves. We knew for a long time that gamma ray bursts were the short ones, the ones that have briefer prompt flash of gamma rays, are linked to neutron stars merging, but all the evidence was indirect until 2017. Some points I hope to get through in the talk I wanted to make is one thing that is useful is that these jets, if you model them, and you somehow create some sort of model for the afterglow signal over time, and you tie this into the data observed at different frequencies, and you can infer the orientation of the system launching the jet, then you have a parameter in common with the ones that are coming directly out of gravitational wave template analysis. So that's helpful. You can have crosstalk between those two types of analysis. This is bona fide multi-messenger astrophysics, of course. That's what you want to do. So the light curve, and if they're close enough, and if they are gravitational wave counterparts, they better be very close, otherwise there wouldn't be a detectable gravitational wave counterpart, they may even be seen to move on the sky. That gives us another constraint on, again, the orientation, for example. Then there is a distinction in burst types. I've been saying neutron star mergers, I've been saying collapsing massive stars. That was always quite binary, where people say it's either that or that, and shorts must be neutron stars merging, and large must be collapsing massive stars. We're now seeing events that sort of are in tension with this notion, so there may be some bleeding into each other of these different categories, which again will have implications for what you could potentially detect as a neutron star merger counterpart if you have a gravitational wave detection. If I keep on going a little bit on the key features of this late stage jet, what you will see if you're observing this is a set of light curves, signals over time as they evolve on fairly short time scales initially, but then logarithmically scale up and still do some evolving, but are showing all sorts of features that tell us something about what is launched, what is going out there, what is the interaction with the medium, and so forth. So this is, for gamma ray burst academics, sort of the one of the main things to explore. There's an afterglow, a broadband afterglow. You will see it in the radio if you wait long enough. Maybe hard to tell apart what's going on here due to radio scintillation or something of the sort. You see X-rays. X-rays we typically see from very early on, and are dedicated satellites like the SWIFT satellite, which slews very fast to a source detected in gamma rays as a prompt emission, and then starting to take X-ray data. And there's optical, which also has additional oddities to it. And eventually, and this is what provided the solid evidence back in the day for the longer burst from the collapsing stars, you would see a supernova emerge, typically a broadlined 1C supernova. This picture, this storyline is sort of repeating itself now for the short burst from the neutron star merges with the kilonova. And of course, the kilonova is a fairly recent addition to the, in terms of being properly detected, to the transient zoo. Sticking a little bit to what is seen. You see here some sort of big pileup plot of light curves detected over time. I'm concentrating on short bursts because they are the ones that are the gravitational wave counterparts. If you see a burst happening, all but one, that counterpart, is detected from a substantial distance. Even the short bursts are detected from a substantial distance. I don't know the average redshift, unfortunately, off the top of my head. But the point is that if you see them, you see them because they're pointing straight at you. They're highly collimated relativistic flows, so if they're not shining directly in your face, then you wouldn't see them. So you would see them bright from the get-go. You would see this decaying signal over time, and you see, again, a collection of X-ray light curves versus a similar collection of optical light curves, and radio data, which is more sparse, is harder to get for gamma ray bursts in general. This is kind of the picture to have in mind. Then there is, of course, that special case, which Jeff mentioned in the intro, and which I alluded to already as well, which is this massive, massive game changer of 1708-17A. For those of you who don't know, 1708-17, of course, is just a date of occurrence, right? So this was 17th of August in 2017. Could be localized thanks to optical detections of this kilonova. It happened hours after the burst. And then if you wait a bit, you would see not just the kilonova, but also the afterglow. Because now the afterglow doesn't start out bright from the get-go. It's not coming directly at you. But you have a different reason to just keep staring at the same point in space. Because there was a prompt emission trigger in gamma rays, and there was a gravitational wave. So everybody and their grandmother took every telescope they had and just kept looking, right? So the Chandra X-ray telescope is depicted here, what it sees. This is the host galaxy. That white circle is 1708-17 in X-rays as it began to emerge after 9 days after the event. You can tell that clearly the white circle is not on top of this one. And that is not unexpected, because short gamma ray bursts, being neutral star mergers, they would have come from a neutral star pair that has experienced natal kicks, right? The neutral stars themselves had to be formed from supernova explosions and so forth. So this would have been flung out of the center or wherever it was exactly formed. So the offsets are not unexpected and seen for most of the short GMEs.
So you're saying the X-ray is only available after 9 days?
In this particular case, yes. We have.
Why is that?
Because the event here is not. I can actually use those boards, or should I not do this with the Zoom crowd? So the normal story is neutron stars merge or whatever happens, or a big star. And we would only be seeing this because it comes directly at us. Like this, because had we been here, actually I have slides showing this later on, we wouldn't be seeing emission that is very strongly beamed, because gamma is going to be 100 or worse, in the direction of motion of the plasma. And if we're here, we're not seeing that. You would expect, though, at very, very long late times, that this blast wave will have quasi-spherically decelerated, and then you would see it. So you expect something called an orphan afterglow, but they're long, long after the event. This is a different case, because now we're not here away, but we're actually sort of here, close by, but off axis. So even though this is not working in our favor, the distance is helping. And we just wanted to see this, so we just kept looking. Normally, if you don't see an afterglow after a day or so, SWIFT has other things to do, it just slews elsewhere, and there's something else going on in the universe. So that makes a difference.
So since you mentioned these orphan afterglows,
yeah.
Have there been searches
for... Oh, yeah.
Like,
yes. I'm not completely up to date, but then that would be... it's probably best to ponder this offline, because it doesn't feature the main... But yes, of course. And there are expectations for orphan afterglows from large surveys. And of course, there was a ZTF. You would have LSST, maybe seen something. Maybe radio and so forth. The question is, can you recognize it as being from a gamma ray burst? Because you can't automatically just connect it with a prompt trigger, given the timescales.
But they are candidates, though, you're saying they're.
Yeah, they're very, yes. The statement that you would see an orphan is not a controversial statement at all. No, it's anyway, so I'm not want to dwell on this particular picture, but I thought I should at least show the gravitational wave template for this particular event. There was a prompt trigger nearly coinciding in time. So this would be just a slight peak in gamma rays, and the counter's going up, followed by what then is a kilo. Ooh, what am I doing? I should do this way. Followed by a kilonova emission. And then, if you wait long enough here, this, for example, is at 9 days, the first X-ray data point that is not part of the kilonova, but bona fide part of the afterglow. What actually, to our surprise, happened was that this thing didn't just show up at 9 days after the event, this guy, but kept on showing, and actually kept on rising in emission, both here in the X-rays, as in the radio, and of course the optical. We didn't have early data, but this is some HST stuff. Before turning over at a later time than expected, we now know why, get to that in a bit, giving us this picture for the burst. And of course, it couldn't brighten indefinitely. It had to decay at some point. So that started to happen about 150 days in. And it decayed with a particular slope, which we predicted would be quite helpful in telling whether or not we actually are seeing something like that. Because you could alternatively posit a scenario where you're not emitting a jet, but some sort of quasi-isotropic, maybe slower moving blob of material, maybe a jet that couldn't push through, or maybe something else entirely. But if you do so, you will not see it decay as fast as that one. So that was a useful datum. Something else which is also interesting and useful to point out, for those of you interested in shock acceleration and particle physics and so forth, is that if you take the lever arm you get from going all the way from radio to X-rays in terms of observations, so radio to X-rays, and you look at the shape of the underlying spectrum, it's typically a featureless synchrotron spectrum, but it has a very long range for which you can very tightly constrain the slope of the synchrotron spectrum. The slope of a synchrotron spectrum is a statement about the acceleration process producing the synchrotron emission, because this is dictated by the distribution of electrons that actually are radiating. So that's a helpful thing to model. The latest, yeah, go ahead.
Where does the, like, this power law, like, next come from?
It comes from here. Now, we just learned that there's tons of blackboards here. If I take the, say, a proxy for electron energy, or just take electron energy following a blast wave, so Lorentz factor, gamma mc squared for electrons. If there is no shock acceleration, then you would get some sort of Maxwellian or Maxwell-Jutner distribution.
Oh,
sorry, this one. Ah, yeah. I thought you meant the slope. Well, this is okay. This is fine, right? So you accelerate to a power law and you get a slope minus P, the dick stays that, yada, yada. This slope is dictated by, well, I'll get there in a few slides, the spreading deceleration of the jet. It's effectively the interaction of the blast with the external medium that drives how it is supposed to decelerate. Moving on one slide, this is one of those, this is basically one of the reasons I'm here, to work with Jeff on pretty much the latest stuff. Well, when we started the paper, it's been a while, on observationally on this event, because it kept going up, it kept going down, and this had the community quite excited for a while because it seemed to do something odd there. Later data points go down again, though, so this seems to have been a bit of a fluke. Or bona fide flare up, or who knows. And as we, where we stand, just to give that away, is a curve based on these underlying jet models that is still consistent with the data, but something, of course, is a little bit suspect there. So worthwhile to consider further. To effectively answer the question was just posed using a few slides, here's what one does when modeling these events, right? You have a, let's say, a simple model for an expanding sphere. Again, a point explosion problem, like the set of Taylor supernova nuclear bomb solution, now allowing for the motion to become relativistic, of which you see a tiny patch, because this part you're not seeing, since that's moving away from you. And relativistic beaming basically runs it out of sight, same issue as over there. And you would see this shell effectively having to sweep up more mass and so forth, So if energy is conserved in this bubble, you kind of know the kinematics of the system because you just smear it out over a larger bubble. So it will have to slow down in a given way over time. So you can predict this minus 0.9, predict, for example, how this would decay over time if this is responsible for the emission by some power law. Once the relativistic dynamics are different, you enter the set of Taylor stage, you get a different decay slope. Because, for example, the beaming effects are no longer making a difference. You're seeing the entire sphere. You're not seeing a patch that grows. So again, you have a component that changes. What you see is this spectrum, the synchrotron spectrum, a featureless spectrum consisting of a series of power laws where this P reflects the slope of the accelerated particles, which I started sketching over there, mistaking a question. If you now go beyond that, and you think, actually, we're not looking at a sphere. Why am I dealing with a sphere? I'm dealing with, at minimum, in terms of modeling simplicity, the conic wedge out of a sphere. That's the best thing you can do if you want to go beyond spheres but don't want to make life too complicated. If this is the case, then at some point, and if this sort of ice cream thing grows and grows its size like that, but it also decelerates, it means that you will actually start to notice there's an edge. There's an absence of stuff coming into your view at higher angles. That means that this slope cannot be sustained, so you have to drop to a different slope. We call this a jet break, and people are keen to pinpoint that when they do X-ray observations of gamma-ray bursts. Eventually, though, you still go to the non-relativistic case, because then the shape is irrelevant. It's just everything is emitting, and you're seeing it all. You can make this more complicated. This is something I've been working on a fair bit. For example, by allowing the jet to spread sideways. I don't know if that came across, but see, I added this. The jet will slow down because, again, you're popping a cork, blowing up a lid off or whatever, and it's highly overpressurized, so it wants to spread. In its own frame, it will expand. If it expands, it increases its working surface, so it will slow down faster. It's sort of a vicious circle that way. So the slope you expect here is to be more steep. And then again, you end up with the usual frame. If you do what I did here, move the observer way off axis, you're not seeing anything at all because beaming is not helping. It's a very, very strong effect, very high power of the Lorentz factor. So it will take a while for it to come into view. And you will start seeing it when everything is sort of into view, so you then move to this jet break stage. This explains, for example, the later slope that we had in this earlier figure, saying we expect for a jetted outflow this slope. We don't expect it to naturally just segue into this one. That was the actual answer to that question. Having said that, this is not what we saw for 170817, that famous neutron star merger event. Instead, we saw this, a more gradual rise. So how do you do that? Well, the answer here is that one step going from a sphere to a conic wedge, that's too simplistic. If your line of sight is grazing the edges of this outflow, you probably need to account for the way that comes into view in more detail. So you have to add structure to your system. So structured jets in our field are all the rage, and they, of course, are part of this modeling that eventually, again, helps you establish the orientation of the system and so forth, and that's the connection to this gravitational wave stuff. So how do we do that then in practice? Again, my life is quite simple, right? I've heard stories now about neutron star equations of state are very hard to resolve. I don't know if, it was you, right? So I don't have all that. It's just protons. It's a completely ionized gas going out there, and I don't even have to worry about GR or anything else that's different. It's just special relativistic hydrodynamics. So this is the star, the jet breaking out pretty much before my time. I joined that group when they did that stuff and started to worry about the expansion of the jet, popping the cork, blowing the lid off, having something that eventually over time becomes like this set of Taylor-like quasi-spherical outflow. The next thing to do, let me get this out of the way, is to take simulation results like that and actually try to reproduce this spectrum that we see. And we do see the various features. If you go all the way down to radio, in lucky cases, you get a lot of the synchrotron spectrum reconstructed. It's effectively a radiative transfer problem. Here too, my life is relatively speaking simple, because I don't need to worry too much about scattering. Synchrotron emission just means I put stuff into the beam, I take stuff out of the beam, if it's self-absorbed at low radio frequencies, and that's it. So it's a linear radio transfer problem that may be a bit of bookkeeping, but ultimately is doable. The bit of bookkeeping is in this animation, where I try to sort of indicate that the jet moving very fast nearly keeps up with its own radiation. So you have to make sure that you resolve everything properly to do this fundamentally simple radio transfer problem in a correct way, in a way that actually is converged. And so you just have your, again, you change your intensity of the ray, which adding stuff, taking stuff out, and you have a prescription, for example, for the peak of the emission that is based on some assumptions about what happens to shock accelerated electrons. So they may be producing synchrotron emission, therefore be proportional to a B field, be more so if the Lorentz factor of the electrons, the bulk Lorentz factor in the fluid is high, and do so in a way that scales with the density and just a bunch of constants of nature, just to give you an indication of the module that we slot in there. There is one way, though, in which I do have a challenge to overcome, so it's not all simple, and that is that these lids are incredibly thin. They're not just Lorentz contracted, if you put them on a computer that is not co-moving, but they also generally have to, on top of that, shrink further, which is due to, I have to be very careful, there's one due to shock heating. So there's a lot of gas. You just compress it by the shock. Sorry, there's a shock compression of the material, and there's Lorentz contraction due to the motion, so it becomes a very, very thin shell. Gamma being 100 or worse means that, of course, your orders of magnitude in the shell width below the actual range of the system. So if you put that on a computer and you try to, for example, resolve a key property of these shells, say it's bulk Lorentz factor, you find that rather than getting this early time blend form key relativistic explosion solution value, you drop by a lot. And these are older simulations, so they don't go up very high. And they only catch up with the asymptote, if at all, at a fairly late stage. And that is getting too small a Lorentz factor if you want to resolve the dynamics, this lateral dynamics, for example, of the jet, when they are sufficiently narrow to be completely relativistic. A narrower jet will spread further because causal contact is established earlier, and that's the kind of case that you're interested in for gamma ray bursts. So that was a technical issue we had to resolve. I'm showing you something here which is actually already out of date, but it's just very nicely elegant, which is if you suppose you have this problem, you want to run a gamma ray burst afterglow simulation. If a big computer code has AMR and the works and everything, still you're not really getting there. The problem being that the jet moves this fast, very thin, and your simulation grid is anchored in, say, the launching point of the burst. The answer here, of course, is to reinterpret your simulation and set it up differently. Because you can just take an entire grid and assume it has a boost Lorentz factor, a fixed boost Lorentz factor. Because then, at least for a while, it will co-move with the outflow. You're not home free yet, right? This is why it got superseded very quickly. Because if you do it that way, then at some point, animation will not really reflect that because it zooms in on part of the flow. If you do it that way, then if your simulation is moving along with a boost, the jet at first will outpace the simulation, but at some point, the jet will slow down enough and it will drop off your grid. So it stops. You can't do the full story. You can't go to non-relativistic because then this whole thing works against you rather than for you. And that's not even mentioning the fact that you have a bipolar jet system, because typically these things tend to be bipolar. And the counterjet, yeah, you're completely messing up any simulation of the counterjets by focusing on the other one. So it's not a be-all and end-all, but it's just a nice thing to implement because you have to, when you launch these things, these are energy and density, I think. Oh, they're pressure and density. And you see this thin shell and it's a fairly sharp profile here on purpose. You see it sort of evolve as it goes away from the source in a way that's numerically resolved. It's kind of nice to do because if the frame is boosted, then, for example, these are not equal times in the lab frame, so you have to do a little bit of special relativity to interpret what's going on. It's kind of nice. More practically speaking, it gets us around this Lorentz factor issue. This beta gamma, so the four velocity, but of course that just reduces to gamma for high values. And you see it hits this asymptotic solution before it decays on account of jet spreading, the kind of dynamics you really want to capture with a computer simulation. So that's one example of the kind of tricks we have in our box of tricks to resolve these things. More recently, well, actually, as a relative statement, already around the time I was messing around with the boost frame stuff in the same group, somebody wrote a code that actually moved the mesh, which in a way is more elegant. Maybe not more elegant, but at least gets the job done more effectively. And just co-flows with the outflow itself. And that would work, because then again, it's Lagrangian thinking, right? Lagrangian dynamics, in a way, as opposed to a Eulerian approach. Jeff actually uses a variety of this code. His code moves the other way around for accretion disks. So again, you have a useful aspect. Now, I thought, I want that. I want that too. So I actually sacrificed a PhD student on the altar of writing codes. And I have my own version of that thing. We put in some extra features, though, to not make it a complete rehash of earlier stuff. And in particular, first of all, we established, of course, that this resolution-wise, totally able to capture the dotted line with the simulation results, meaning it really resolves the jet before it starts to spread. But also, it traces, in this particular case, some features of the accelerated particle population. In particular, the... In particular, this feature, this turnover at very high frequencies in the synchrotron spectrum, which has to do with the hot electron population. If you accelerate electrons at the shock front, they will cool down very quickly because they lose the energy through synchrotron emission. And the faster they move, there was a gamma squared a few slides ago, so the faster electrons move, the faster they cool. So of this thin shell, only a thinner bit will be radiating at very high energies because they are hot enough to do so. You want to trace this population, so that's another resolution issue that we could overcome with this moving mesh code. And you can see that if you take this approach where you properly follow that population rather than just, even if you have fancy hydrodynamics, estimate more broadly the emission, that there can be a massive change, compare the orange dots blocks to the blue dots, for example, between where you figure this critical frequency lies. And that matters because that ultimately goes down to what do you actually infer from a data set about the energy of the explosion and so forth. So that's the thing we also have been doing. And that gets us to trying to model now these kind of events and see how, for example, over time, the width of the outflow taking different measures, or different approaches of the jet structure, evolves over time. And you would need that to, in particular, work out what happens at late stages. Because I showed you some slides ago, why don't I just go back a few slides then? Let's see if I can do that. I showed you this, right? The potential tension. This is a statement about a tension between data and a jet model. But this is a jet model at late stages, where it is indeed undergoing spreading. So if you're not doing this properly, then you may be off. And that means that your assessment of what actually is going on here, is this a kilonova afterglow, for example, or is this a feature from a long-lived engine, which not necessarily then became a black hole for some reason, is informed by how well you do these simulations. So it's not just occupational therapy for my group. It has actually repercussions outside. One thing you can do is, how long am I supposed to talk, actually?
20.
Sorry?
20 minutes.
Okay, so I got time for everything. I think you guys would like this, actually. If not, then you're a captive audience, right? But so this is actually something that's quite nice that we've been doing for a while now, is that if you actually run these simulations, what you ideally want to do is have a data set, have a simulation, and make sure that the two can be compared directly. On the other hand, what you want to do is if you have a data set, you want to have some sort of model which you can iteratively fit, right? You want to do, for example, a whole Markov chain Monte Carlo approach through parameter space of the model. Now, you can't do these kind of simulations even if they're not that expensive compared to whatever. I'm not running Millennium all the time. You can't do this iteratively. You have to do something to get out of that. You want to, for example, eliminate dimensions of your parameter space if you can. Particular dimensions would be the energy of the explosion or the density of the environment. So what is actually quite obvious, in hindsight certainly, is that you can just run a simulation First of all, take the output. You see the jet, you have all these nice instabilities that don't really matter. They look nice on the figure. They take computational resources to resolve, but they do nothing at all really for the emission, because that's all happening here. So if you acknowledge that fact, you can of course just winzip the output in a way. You could just say, I just want to have a few zones here and there that are pretty much, with our understanding of the geometry of the system, concentrated where the emission is. So that's the trick. That helps. So at least you have compressed the data output. But there's something else which is quite useful, which is that actually, if I have a fairly basic set of parameters for my explosion, and in this case we do, we have an energy of the explosion, we have maybe an opening angle, and we have a surrounding density, because think of these point explosion problems, we can just rescale in the same way you run a computer simulation in code units and then go to some energy that this is supposed to represent. You can do this, of course, here as well. So that means you have a baseline simulation which you just scale up and down to match any energy and density ratio that you think happens for this particular burst. So that is a scale invariant that's useful if you combine it with this compression of data, because you can't rescale, for example, initial collimation angles. They're generally dimensionless parameters, so they're generally an extra dimension in the system. So make it simple, tabulate along opening angle initial conditions, rescale among energies and densities, and you have a toolkit that you can then combine to form at least the dynamics in a scale invariant manner for whatever gamma ray burst in the short GRB or long GRB case results. This is kind of belaboring that point, though. I don't know if you guys, again, know this Benford-McKee solution, but the Sedley-Taylor solution, this may even look familiar. Do people know this Sedley-Taylor solution?
It's been a long time.
What happens here is that there's only one, if you only have an explosion energy, a circumburst density, and this is a sphere, again, nuclear bomb, blows up over time. There's only one way, given that it's density, energy, radius, and time that matters, that any quantity, for example, the density of this profile as a function of the density of the profile divided by the external density, some dimensionless quantity, will have to depend on this one combination. That's the only thing that can be done, because other combinations are not dimensionless. This is the core of self-similarity. So that works. You have this. And in practice, if you do a set of Taylor solution, you are not dealing with relativistic issues. You just effectively have this aspect, this other thing that may screw up your dimensional analysis, the speed of light. Doesn't matter, right? You don't worry about that. Conversely, if you go to very, very early times, the speed of light does matter, because everything is in this small shell that pretty much keeps up with its emission. But you are, again, in a limiting situation. So here you have these self-similarity solutions that are just facets of a larger invariance in scales that you can see here. Because what if I indeed say I'm going to run my explosion at a larger energy, increase the energy by a factor of 10 or so, but simultaneously compensate for that by rescaling my time and radius as well, these coordinates stay invariant. So it means I have a scale invariant dynamical system, if you will. Again, it's just pounds versus dollars, or miles versus kilometers, in a way. So that's kind of neat for the purpose of this actual data analysis. As it turns out, and that was slightly less obvious, but actually very useful in the end as well, you can actually take this notion and move it forward, because these are all statements about dynamics of a system. But we want to model the emission. But we are modeling the emission from a set of power laws. We're doing this synchrotron system. Power laws are inherently scale-free. And there may be all sorts of prefactors of I don't know, Thomson cross-section, proton mass, electron mass, and so forth, that clutter the appearance of the scale invariance in a given synchrotron spectral regime. But ultimately, these kind of translations feature in characteristic features, like, let's say, a turnover frequency or a peak flux level, in a prescribed way. Again, it's not immediately obvious which value to put in the index because of extra dimension carrying quantities that sort of clutters the thing, but it's not ultimately stopping you from being able to take a light curve. This is again an on-axis example. You see something very bright from the beginning, decaying over time. This would be a jet break turnover. This would be the counter jet that eventually you would see. And you can take simulations at different energy, run emission predictions from them, and pretty much map them onto each other exactly just because of this dimensional rescaling. So here too, we have something that's kind of useful. This gets us towards thinking in terms of templates, right? Now you can build a template database of light curves, and you can do template fitting. So that means you can very quickly run through all the options for a particular event and fit the template. So you have a whole pretty much flowchart of, let's say there's a gamma ray burst. This is data collected by the Swift XRT telescope, X-ray data. Bright at first, doing whatever it does at later times. This is all just automatically produced online, right? This is the Swift website. There's a group of Leicester who does this. And you can sort of take your favorite approach to working out what's going on. So either you take your data set and you do the observer approach. You just fit power laws and post hoc interpret the power laws. There's a way of doing so. It's called closure relations, just some sort of physical interpretation to attach to a power law. Or you actually try to get a model that you can connect to a data set directly in one way or another way. This is the most expensive option. You just run simulations, bespoke simulations. Nice if you can do it, but not, of course, a practical thing to do, and maybe not feasible. Or you build like a, oops, I use this one, or you build a template database to work from that. And there too, you can do different things. You can actually run a repeated radius transfer problem on the dynamical level, or you actually go to a template database of spectra directly. And then ultimately, you can take your approach to data fitting. This is something, again, I've worked a lot on with Jeff. The red text now indicates one way of doing this. This would be the full template database for simulation-produced light curves. And to give an example, here you see a data set, again, from Swift, and a curve that is produced from a high resolution 2D jet simulation of an expanding jet, and it's just made to match by just walking through these templates. Having done this for a larger sample of events, larger sample of of long gamma ray bursts in practice, we're able to fit not only a distribution of initial collimation angles, they tend to peak around 0.1 radian, 5 or 6 degrees or so, with some tail towards broader jets. Apparently, our model suggests that. But also, we can start moving the observer a little bit off axis. This is pre-170817, so we only thought about moving between here and here a little bit, and seeing if that made a difference. It did, and you can constrain these values. And it sort of seems to reproduce what you expect, because there are, of course, more ways of seeing a jet not pointed at you. There's only one option. Did that sentence work out? No, that didn't go anywhere. So you can see a jet from an angle in various ways. You can only see it on axis in one way, right? So if jets are randomly oriented, occurring in a random oriented way in the sky, you would see them more slightly off axis. You would still only see them pretty much pointed at you if they come from a large distance, because of this beaming stuff. Would you expect there to be some sort of ratio between how you are within the opening angle of the jet that tends closer to 1 than it tends to 0 directly on axis? So you expect this rather than this, is what I'm saying. And that is sort of confirmed with these kind of tests.
So there, by data, you mean really data, there's no cosine or anything. So you're applying from 0 to 0.5.
Sorry? Here. Yes, yes. So we know they're all narrow jets, yes. And there is a I mean, you could extend that and find, yes, they're all narrow jets. The reason you know this is because of the massive energy scales, which I didn't even properly mention. But the isotropic equivalent energy, so the energy it would have had it been a spherical explosion, tend to be on the order of 10 to the 53 erg. So clearly something has to give, because that sometimes is seen high. So you know that we're probably seeing a fraction of the, that's not even mentioning that you see those jet breaks. There are point sources, though, so it's not that obvious. It takes a while. It took the community a while to get the jet model confirmed. Now, if you, I owe credit to Jeff for this particular animation. He may have shown it to you already. Here again, you see light curves. You see them turn over to reflect the nature of the jetted outflow. And you see different colors here, and they represent jets that have different structure at the edges, different lateral structures of energy. What this particular setup tells you is that this notion of going from a sphere in the beginning to a conic wedge as one step up is actually fairly defensible if you're looking more or less on axis. The fluff at the edges does not really impact the bright spot, even if it broadens out, that you would normally see from a gamma ray burst. So there was no real practical need to incorporate any fancy structure in the jet as it is launched from the system. Story becomes wildly different, though, if you move to an off-axis setup. If you move, Jeff moves the Earth, but of course we should move the burst, you see the signals become completely different, right? Now, this top hat meaning, so why do we call this top hat? Top hat means, this is a top hat, right? Well, that's a pointy hat. why I did a... This is a top hat. So I'm saying that as a function of angle, the energy is fixed until some sort of collimation angle. This is the conic wedge. I hope you can see that from there, but you can't, can you?
No.
Okay. The point is flat energy distribution in the top hat model. That was the one we needed, was sufficient at the beginning, most simple option. You can have this go in different ways. Gaussian, a power law, they tend to coincide depending on the power law slope and the Gaussian core width. That reflects that there is less energy at the edges. And of course there will be, because you can't launch, you're not launching gamma ray burst jets in a clean room, right? You have to, this is a messy system and it has to go through this environment and so forth. That's not even mentioning magnetic fields, by the way. If you actually do mention magnetic fields, they will also presumably in this launching process induce structure. So that matters, for example, for gravitational wave counterparts, because they are seen off axis. They will then exhibit a different profile. Here too, the credit goes to Jeff. We built together a model that sets up this time a slightly more simple way, because we didn't want to run all these structured jet simulations to start fitting. A jet built up out of concentric rings of simpler jets. And you can, from that, as the light goes up and comes down from each concentric ring, in a combined fashion, produce a rising slope for the light curve over time. So you're seeing the edge coming into view first, and you're moving your line of sight closer and closer towards actually seeing the tip, because the thing slows down and the tip is no longer de-beamed or beamed away from you, in a way that has this ring structure dictate the slope of this rising stage. And as Jeff worked out, you can use that information to very quickly just seeing the rising slope as an observer without going whole hog on big simulations or whatever, work out just from this slope, at minimum, the ratio between the orientation of the system and the core width, the core opening angle, the representative Gaussian distribution width of the jet. So this is already quite useful if you want to have a quick handle on what's going on here. What should I expect? What is my follow-up strategy, for example? And again, I keep making this point, but this, of course, ties in with the gravitational wave connection. You can model these jet structures in different ways. And there are different practical approaches to go with. The colored curves here are like what I sort of sketched on the board there, different profiles with angle of the energy in the jets. And they allow for different parameterizations. And this, for example, this gray line would be a Gaussian structured jet matching these particular simulations. Now, jet simulations are a dime a dozen, so it takes a while, of course, in the community for the dust to settle on what is actually the truth. That's the thing we've been working on. An added constraint, ultimately, that we will need to take into account is a very spectacular observation for the 1708-17 neutron star merger counterpart, which is the motion of the centroid, the image of across the sky, peaking at some position that is no longer a point source sticking to its initial spot, but something that slightly moves. Slightly moves mean milliarcseconds. So observationally speaking, it's almost nothing, but corresponds to apparent superluminal motion. It's, of course, a well-known phenomenon where something appears to move with more than the speed of light. It's just a projection effect of something moving also very rapidly towards you. This is indicative of a jetted source as well, because a sphere expanding will never move from its initial position. So this is another datum in your jet model that you want to fit for. And of course, that's what we've been doing. So to get to that point, I will probably stop at some point the presentation, if I find a natural point to do so. You can take this route. We took the other route earlier, because I wanted to share this stuff about rescaling and so forth, which is just something I find very interesting. But for structured jet models, we still have this, semi-analytical models. It takes time to get the simulations done. You can take that semi-analytical model and you can just work with it and then make for a Bazin's fits. Jeff, again, he is the one who is sort of in charge of the public release code that does this and that's been used. It's not the Boxford code, which he mentioned in the beginning, but a more recent follow-up. And if you do so, you can find, you can get this whole triangular table, right? You've probably all seen varieties of this, right? When you do a large fit, lots of parameters, Bayesian fit, you get posterior results, probability distributions of the initial parameters that may or may not exhibit all sorts of cross connections, degeneracies. Here, I'm just taking the tip of the iceberg of a larger table of fit parameters. There would be the density as well of the environment. There would be a slew of parameters describing the synchrotron process. But the parameters here that are interesting are the observer angle, the orientation of the system in degrees, this core width opening angle, and for example, the energy of the explosion, at least a measure of the explosion energy. I don't know, actually, off the top of my head, that this is the integrated energy. Is this integrated? Do you know this?
Yes.
It's total energy in the jet, right?
Yeah.
Here you see this tight constraint from the slide ago, I think, to some extent, the one that Jeff quantified.
So it seems this prior range for theta observation is not big enough, right? Because you see a lot of...
Yeah. But I'm going to get to why this is nonsense. Well, this is not nonsense. This is really preliminary stuff. And this range is picked here to clarify actually where we're heading. And we're going to be solidly within the box later on. This is a fit to the afterglow that was a gravitation wave counterpart. So gravitation wave templates indicated an angle already, and I will get to what difference that makes if you fold this into the analysis. But if you now assume, and the red dot is already in the right place, if you assume these jets are randomly oriented on the sky, that means they're more likely to be seen pretty much from the side than on axis, you would get this posterior. If you only have data up to 180 days, so there has been a whole slew of papers, in that sense it was good job security, right, 1787, because it gives you, here's our first data point, spectacular, first X-ray point ever. Here's another one. They weren't all Nature papers, and they weren't literally, here's another one, but there were certain features that deserved separate papers, like, oh, it keeps on rising very slowly. Oh, it actually peaks. Oh, we can now finally establish that the decaying slope has a certain value. So these are pretty much used to help inform these fit results. So if you take this as a starting point, you end up with a very broad distribution, broader than, and higher, certainly for the orientation, far more off axis than you'd expect based on gravitational waves. If you keep on going, not caring about gravitational wave information, just leaving it out there, just separately looking at the afterglow, it actually moves towards broader and broader, which is not ideal. It just has to accumulate this shape of the light curve at later stages. And it wants to become very, very broad. The red dot is actually on the spot and is marking something quite uncomfortable from the perspective of what is supposed to be seen in gravitational waves. So at some point, it just gets a little bit out of hand. It also wants to be off axis and have a large core, relatively speaking, because the ratio is tightly constrained, in order to get bright late time emission, which we have been seeing. On the other hand, if you actually properly include a prior on the gravitational wave, sorry, how does that work? So you have a prior on the orientation, which is informed by the gravitational wave posterior for the orientation, which in turn then included an assumption about the Hubble constant when you did the gravitational wave stuff, not my part of the work here, you actually have a different position for the observer angle. So obviously, the prior informs your posterior. So a strong prior gives you a strong constraint on your posterior. And you can see still how this drifts toward larger and larger orientations. You can see it moving rightwards. If you actually include more and more data.
Sorry, but yeah. The H0 assumption is wrong. I mean, you can run at zero angles, but in which aspect was H0 needed? Is for distance? Or?
For the, yeah, but the orientation and distance, so again, I'm a little bit out of my depth if I address this. But the issue, my understanding is that the direction of the system is somewhat degenerate with the distance to the system.
Yeah, it's very.
And that is something that features in. So what I'm saying is that there is a posterior from the gravitational wave template analysis for the orientation of the system, which is pretty broad still,
right.
But it was something about 20 degrees or so where we expect this to be in terms of orientation. And that is falling in. I think that this, to get to that posterior on the gravitational wave side, you need to make assumptions about cosmology. I think that's the...
I actually was hoping that, I was going to ask you later, but maybe I can ask you now. The hope was at some point that, well, one knows enough about the astrophysics to constrain the orientation.
Yeah.
So go the other way around.
That's exactly where we hope to be going. And that's in a way, the kind of stuff we're already beginning to do here, right? There's actually a follow-up paper. People are now fitting, co-fitting. You're kind of, this is coming. not to the depth that I think covers the latest papers. There's some publications going out there where we're doing this. But going back for 1 second. So we have this. We have a bit of an uncomfortably large angle. And we had a signal that was fairly bright at late times relative to the jet model. So you could ponder, maybe there's an additional source of emission. What if we sort of co-fit for that? And we don't need this jet model to make up for all the bright stuff at late times. Then you can actually move a little bit further to the left, again with your inferred orientation, at the cost of introducing an extra source of emission. But as it turns out, the centroid stuff, which I already mentioned, actually is incredibly constraining. The position on the sky, even so a few milliarc seconds, that actually makes a substantial difference. It tells you that, oh, if I do the analytical the analysis of the afterglow light curve plus centroid plus information on the gravitational wave, I find indeed a fairly tight constraint on the orientation. This is what you want. This is sort of getting at your point, right? You want to have these constraints tight because indeed, in turn, you can go the other way around. You can, for example, just co-fit everything if your gravitation. And that, of course, is something that can get out of hand because there's tons of parameters in the gravitational wave fits as well. But in principle, that's what you want to do. You have the ultimate resources, you just want to do this for all parameters in one big monstrous fit. If you include extra luminosity again, you can see this change a little bit, but not by all that much. So the centroid was the big player in terms of constraining the orientation. You don't really need the extra luminosity. And as a matter of fact...
if you remove H0 in that plot, how wide is the peak?
If I do not take care of H0, then I go, you mean including, so what I have to show you is without including the gravitational wave prior, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, then it just became very wide. So where was I go?
If you fit everything, once you have the centroid, the gravitational wave prior doesn't matter anymore.
That is true, yeah,
so
yeah.
This is,
Yeah.
The distribution of Harlan changes.
Yes, so this is one thing I have, for example, with that. But also, yeah, I don't think I prepared a combination of the different permutations here. Right? Centroid, gravitational wave prior, and extra luminosity. And you're asking about the permutation, which I don't have on the slide. But yes, Jeff's point is stands. But, you can see, indeed, that the centroid is the big deal. So what is this about, then? Here, this last bit matters. Everybody was all up in arms about potential extra, kilonova afterglow, who knows what. But it turns out that it went up and it sort of came down and it's kind of matching the light curves still. There is some tension at 2 sigma level, but not all that big. This is one of the things that Jeff and I are currently wrapping up a paper about. If you do include the extra luminosity term, yeah, clearly you get extra luminosity. So it works in that sense a little bit better. It does help a little bit with the centroids as well. It just looks a little bit better if you compare those two. And the crosses should be in the blue circles. It's that simple, right? One of them is the data, the other one is where we put it in terms of our modeling. There's a bit, you're not supposed to be able to read this. I'm just saying it's a part of a big pile of fit parameters that go into this kind of analysis. And that's sort of where we are. What I want to do is I want to move towards wrapping up, I think, because I can't keep you hostage for that long. I want to make very quickly then some last point, which I alluded to in the beginning, which is that we tend to think there are long gamma ray bursts and there are short gamma ray bursts. This is an old paper, a very old paper, a classic in the field saying, oh, actually it's a bimodal distribution and you can get better versions of this plot later on. Where on the one hand, the long burst pretty much beyond 2 seconds or more, this is not a hard boundary, are due to massive star collapse, and the short ones due to neutral star mergers, where anyway the free fall collapse scale is shorter. So you have kind of a physical reasoning to believe different times. And the short bursts are the gravitational wave counterparts potentially. They will be offset from the host galaxy. We covered that with those kicks. They may come with a kilonova. Okay, that was something that we really properly detected for, including lines and so forth, for this gravitational wave counterpart. But there have been claims before that, but not in any detailed observation. And of course, with the gravitational waves. But the problem is that this divide is not always completely clear. So let me give you an example. This is a paper from last year, where we have a burst that actually lasts for 10 seconds, so well to the right of this left 2-second peak. But we couldn't model properly. So let's look at the dashed lines over time for the different frequencies with just a jet model. Something extra is happening. And that extra that is happening, also seen here, if you look in frequency space, is some sort of near thermal bump on top. And a kilonova, like a supernova, looks like a pretty much like a thermal thing, if you look at it across frequencies. So the argument here is that, oh, this thing is not part of this featureless synchrotron slope, and may actually be evidence of a kilonova. And if you look at certain properties of the system, for example, the evolution of the bolometric luminosity of this bump, you can see that the black dots for this current event do a very similar thing as the gray dots for this confirmed kilonova from the neutral star merger. The same thing with temperature and radius from very simple modeling, right? From assuming it's a thermal source. And you find yourself then having to figure out, what is this? Is this a short burst or a long burst? Because if there's no supernova, then where is the supernova? Is there a massive star collapsing? There should be a supernova. And if there is a kilonova must come from the neutral star merger. What other properties then, for something that by time of the prompt emission looks to be a long one, are there to differentiate? The duration, like I said, it's the yellow star is in the wrong pile of dots there, right? Because it was, if it's a kilonova, neutral star merger, it should have been among the black short ones. On the other hand, again, doing it wrong. Here, I should be pointing at this for the people back home. On the other hand, there are other properties, like, for example, this is a nice one. The prompt emission seen across gamma ray frequencies tends to peak at a given gamma ray frequency that correlates with the total energy it's putting out there. It's an E-peak, E-iso correlation. And they lie, all the long ones lie on some sort of line in this space of prompt emission gamma ray peak position versus gamma ray energy. And the short ones lie elsewhere. Here it is playing ball. It actually is in the right population. So there are different ways of telling these populations apart. For example, how rapidly the emission varies over time. This is this horizontal axis versus this X-ray fluence. That also puts it in a bit of an odd spot. So it's an odd one. There are more odd ones. This is an example of an odd one going the other direction. This is called a discovery and confirmation of the shortest gamma ray burst from a collapsar, meaning a collapsing massive star, that also doesn't play ball. And there are more examples. I'm not going to dwell on these in the view of time. Also, they're not my work, so I don't know all the fine details here. But the titles sort of tell the story already, right? You have a peculiarly short duration gamma ray burst from a massive star collapse. That's another example of something that's actually maybe due to neutron star mergers. Here's another example of something weird. No supernova. Where is the supernova? The burst was long. There should be a supernova, or at least some signature of massive star collapse. So maybe these two are actually neutral star mergers. Here's another one. Again, where did the supernova go? It was supposed to be seen. And this point I already made. If you actually can see or model an excess as a kilonova, that at least gives you something to work with, right? So I'm nearly there. This is the latest thing. We just submitted this. We're pretty down, far down the author list. We didn't do much here other than model the afterglow part. But here again is a burst detected over here, which seems to be a long one. Time scale indicates that. But actually, beyond that, has again this set of properties that are consistent with kilonova emission. So ultimately, what this means is that if you do some sort of assessment of what is the rate of these long bursts that actually sneakily from neutral stars merging, you expect to be about 10% of these cases to be, how did I go? Jeff, you need to help me here. That probably 10% of the gravitational wave detected neutral star merger events may actually come from these longer ones that masquerade as, may come from these neutral star mergers that masquerade as long GRBs. And I'll leave you with that. And I'm very sorry, but nobody stopped me on time, I think, right? So you should just stop me.
Thank you very much. We're a bit over time with any quick questions.
So these simulations you showed are, I guess, we'll assume axis symmetry. So if you allow non-axis symmetric configurations, I mean, do you think the jet will change along propagation, or are there any?
Yeah, there's a few things that will happen. This is mostly an issue, though, for the crowd that models the actual propagation of the jet directly after birth and its emergence. One thing that could happen, for example, is the following. The signal over time. Actually, I have a slide. What am I doing? I have a slide for everything, except for the other questions you asked. All the way in the beginning. I had this sort of characteristic shape. There we go. We've been pretty much talking about this part, decaying, showing a jet, and doing all sorts of other stuff. If you look at earlier times, very early times, the dynamics will be affected more by the initial ejecta, because you will not yet have transferred most of the energy to a blast wave going into the environment, and it's not going to be the environment, which again is this more generic behavior, that dictates the outflow. So this early stage will be feeling that effect more. And let's say you try to, push this lid out. If you have a 3D simulation, you will have means to sort of get around that. You will not have something blocking, a blockage, when you try to propagate a jet. So this is one example, but there are other examples. And maybe they're processing a little bit, who knows, right? Going to 3D always can be, I can, though, reasonably comfortably say that at later stages, magnetic fields are not a big worry anymore, because they only matter close to the launching site. They will potentially, there will be some residual magnetization of the ejecta that is helpful to get something for the synchrotron emission, but it's not dynamically important anymore.
Okay. With that, people keep